Jim Harris is one of North America's foremost thinkers on change and leadership. As a best-selling author and consultant, he speaks internationally at over 50 conferences a year on the issues that most concern executives: leadership, change, customer relationship management, e-learning, future trends, and creating a learning organization. Association Magazine has ranked him as one of North America's top speakers. His clients include Barclays Bank, Columbia TriStar Pictures, Deloitte & Touche, Ford, General Motors, Glaxo Welcome, the International Council of Shopping Centers, Johnson & Johnson, MasterCard, Munich Re, Nortel Networks, the UK Cabinet Office, and Zurich Insurance. Mr. Harris's new book, Blindsided, is a number one international bestseller, having appeared on the Financial Times of London's European Edition Business Bestseller List. Blindsided is published in 80 countries worldwide by John Wiley & Sons of New York and was named one of the best business books of the year by CEO Refresher. SoundView's executive summaries featured Blindsided as one of the 30 best business books of the year, sending a summary to 80,000 subscribers worldwide. The Miami Herald calls Blindsided brilliant stuff, worthwhile to bestow on one CEO. While Claire Hart, CEO of Factiva, says Blindsided is a must-read for all senior executives. Thousands of executives have benefited from applying this material within their organizations. We now join Jim giving a live presentation on Blindsided.
Thank you so much for that warm welcome. Does anybody here hate those error messages you get in Windows? You know, Windows drives me crazy. You know, well, one company, thankfully, has decided to do something about it. Anybody here seen those Sony Vaios? New notebook, about an inch thick from Sony, only 3 pounds, you know, really cool. Well, Sony has decided to rewrite all their error messages. But because they're a Japanese company, they've decided to do them in haiku. So these are some of the error messages you can expect if you get a new Sony Vaio. A file that big, it must be very useful, but now it is gone. Or how about this one? Yesterday it worked. Today it is not working. Windows is like that. Or how about three things are certain: death, taxes, and lost data. Guess which has occurred? I'm so excited to be talking to you tonight about Blindsided. Blindsided has been released in 80 countries around the world, and it's now a number one international bestseller because it hit the number one position on the Financial Times of London's European edition. We're going to look at some questions. Really, the central question is, can a business appear to be healthy and yet actually be dead? So think about this. Polaroid filed for bankruptcy in 2001. The company that came to define what instant photography is was blindsided by the rapid rise of digital photography. Polaroid defined what instant photography was, and it went bankrupt because it didn't pay attention to a change in the marketplace. Or I love to talk about how an 18-year-old has decimated the profitability of a $40 billion industry. Sean Fanning, with the release of Napster, has changed forever the way the music industry will work. Why are organizations being blindsided? What are laws? I'm going to talk about a dozen laws that guarantee this will not just continue but accelerate. How can we identify early warning signs? How can we avoid being blindsided? And then, as in many martial arts, what can be used defensively can be used offensively. How can we blindside our competition? Really, we're working in an environment that is fundamentally different. So here's how long it took different technologies to reach 1/4 of the North American households. It took electricity 46 years, car 44, phone 35, TV 26, PC 15, cell phone 13, but the web less than 7. And once the web is in place, it becomes the digital infrastructure that enables everything else to accelerate, because it allows something I call flash pointing to occur. Another way to look at it is how long it took different technologies to reach 10 million customers. It took radio 20 years, or 240 months. It took TV 10 years. It took Netscape 28 months. It took Hotmail 18 months. And it took Napster only 9 months. Now, when a technology can be adopted by 10 million people in under 1 year, something has changed. This is what Blindsided is all about. So let's actually look at Napster. Napster, as I mentioned, was created by this 18-year-old kid in his dorm, and he just emailed it to 10 of his friends. And they got so excited about the ability to switch MP3s with each other, they told their friends who told their friends. So he released it in late August, and by November, 1 million people had downloaded the software. Staggering. By February, it was 5 million. By April, it was 10. By June, it was 15. By July, it was 20 million people. And here, the recording industry in its wisdom decided to sue Napster. And what was the net effect? 18 million people were turned on to Napster by the publicity around the court case. And when Napster died in February of 2001, 62 million people had downloaded Napster. Now, I don't know if you know the myth of the Greek Hydra, but when you cut off the Hydra's head, 6 new heads spring up. And the day that Napster died, 90 new file sharing services sprung up. And you know, over the next 6 months, they consolidated. And a half year later, the top 4 were facilitating more file transfers than Napster had at its peak. Wow. You know, it's about 3 billion files a month are being traded across the internet. The second generation of file sharing services doesn't just threaten the recording industry, it threatens Hollywood too. Why? Because the day after Harry Potter was released in movie theaters, I could download the entire movie over the web. Why? Because some kid went into a theater with a digital camera, a tripod, like that Seinfeld episode, set it up and filmed the entire movie. And the reason you can tell that is partway through the movie, you'll see this. That's someone going out of the row in front of you to get their popcorn and coming back. So, you know, it's not just going to change the recording industry, it's going to change Hollywood as well. Really, here's the principle. It is easier to step on a dragon's egg than it is to step on a dragon. You know, if there is some new trend that's going to change your industry, it's better to get in early than it is to get in late. This is what I call the two gorilla theory of change. On the one hand, we have the $40 billion recording industry lobbying Capitol Hill and Parliament Hill to put in new legislation. And on the other hand, we have the $150 billion PC industry saying exactly the opposite. Because you see, it's driving PC sales, and the broadband industry, which sells high-speed internet, saying this is what's driving broadband adoption. So on the one hand, you have recording industry in Hollywood, and the other, PC and high-speed internet, which guarantees there will continue to be a clash, and the recording industry will continue to be blindsided. Because you see, the whole environment is changing. Really, if the rate of external change exceeds the rate of internal change, disaster is imminent. In other words, if the market is changing faster than your business is, or faster than you are, or faster than your organization is changing systems and structures, disaster is imminent. Or really, this is Darwin's finding. It's not the strongest species, it's not the most intelligent species, it's not even the fastest species that survive. It's the ones most capable of changing or adapting in a changing world. So does blindsiding affect all industries? Well, do you know, for the first time in 53 years, sales of chocolate bars fell in the United Kingdom. And what was it? Was it the sweet makers that did it to them? No, because their sales fell too. Was it the crisp makers, what they call potato chips? No. What was it then? Well, you know, kids today, the rage in Europe is called SMS, short text messaging. That's where kids who have mobiles send emails to their friends on their mobiles. It's the big rage, and kids have limited income. So what they're choosing to do is buy a £5 pay-as-you-go top-up card for their mobile rather than buy a Kit Kat or a Mars bar. Now, if you and I were executives for a chocolate bar company, do you think in our strategic planning sessions we'd be looking at the cell phone companies as our competitors? No. You see, every organization can be blindsided. So it's absolutely critical to think about, and during the course of tonight's presentation, we're going to be looking at the challenges. Tomorrow morning, we're going to spend 90 minutes looking at some of the solutions. So here are some of the laws that guarantee that blindsiding is not just going to continue, but accelerate. And the first one is Moore's Law. Any of you know or ever bought one of those singing birthday cards that when you open they sing to you? Do you know that in that birthday card there is more raw computing power than on the entire first lunar landing module? Bit of a worry if you're an old astronaut, eh? Do you know that my new Dell computer has more raw computing power than IBM's most powerful mainframe of just 10 years ago? And do you know that in 10 years' time, I will have something that powerful as my notebook in the size of a wristwatch? Now, here's a simple principle. Microsoft assumes whatever the size of your hard disk on an average system, a new system today, that will be the amount of RAM on an average system in 7 years' time. So I just bought a new notebook with 60 gigs of hard drive. So in 7 years' time, I'll have 60 gigs of RAM. Woohoo! That's an average system. You want a really hot system, you get 120 gigs. Woohoo! Now, what are we going to do with all this power? You know, we're not going to do what we currently do. We will have what I call an audio user interface. Like Jean-Luc Picard, we will talk to our computers. We won't have a GUI, a graphical user interface. Or we'll have something I call universal real-time translation. That's where I video conference with someone in Japan by putting a little camera on the top of my notebook. They see me, but they don't hear English. They hear me speaking Japanese. Universal real-time translation. Might that change your business? One of the key principles, though, is we have to be able to continually learn to take advantage of this new technology. Metcalfe's Law. Metcalfe's Law says, what is the value of the network? The value of the network rises exponentially with each incremental person. And what does that mean in simple English? It means with the web, 615 million people have moved to the web within 10 years. The web was born in 93 with the release of Mosaic, or 94 with Netscape, 615 million users. Or it explains the eBay phenomena, why eBay has grown so quickly. Gilder's Law. Gilder's Law says that bandwidth expands three times as fast as Moore's Law, so that bandwidth doubles every 6 months. So what does that mean? Look at this. This woman is wearing a wearable computer screen. Think about when you're listening to a Walkman and you have those little earbuds in. Take those earbuds out, hold them out here, and you can barely hear the thing. But when they're in your ears, you're rocking and rolling. The same principle applies when I put a computer screen this close to my eye. This screen actually looks like a 60-inch screen. So this is going to change the way car mechanics work. Why? Because I could be a brand new car mechanic and not know how to change something in the engine, but I could have this wearable screen attached to a little computer on my hip, because computers are this big now, that's Wi-Fi or wirelessly tied to a server, and streaming video of how to change this part. I've never changed it before. I can watch it, then actually do it on the car. Might this change the whole auto industry? And given that there's no profit really in the auto industry in selling the cars, because we've had 0% financing for so long now, the real money is in the service. Might this change the whole dynamic of the auto industry and blindside organizations that don't keep up with the technology? Coase's theorem. This is quite interesting. Coase wrote a paper in the 1930s, said the reason organizations, traditional companies, got so large is because they insourced functions, meaning it was cheaper to do your accounting in-house, so they'd hire people. But today, the web changes all that. Do you know many organizations today are uploading their financials to India overnight, where all the financial analysis is done, and then the figures are re-uploaded to North America in the morning before people arrive for work? And are those people participating and working in the North American economy? Do they have green cards or Canadian immigration papers? Do they pay taxes here? You see, it's changing the entire dynamic. Here's an interesting thing. Think about that one about bandwidth expanding three times as fast. Do you know that Blockbuster Video last year made $796 million from us in late charges? Oh, a bit more from you, eh? Now, the people in the marketing department got together and they did a brainstorming session. And they now call them extended viewing charges. Doesn't that make you feel so much better? Well, think about this. When we begin to consume our movies digitally, video on demand, what happens to 16% of Blockbuster's profit? Because there are no late charges when you watch something digitally. You download it, it waits there until you watch it, and then it deletes itself. Boom. No late charges. What happens to Blockbuster? Like, whoever said this is a positive customer experience? You and your spouse get in the car, you drive to the video store, you walk around arguing, you know, for 10 minutes about what you should get. Oh, you've been there too, right? And then you get home. By the way, you got a parking ticket. You get home, and halfway through the movie, the DVD begins skipping. I hate it when that happens. Or you find the clerk has put the wrong video in the sleeve. And then you have to get up early in the morning before going to work and return the darn thing in rush hour traffic. Who defined that as a positive customer experience? You see, once we can consume video digitally, we're going to do it like that as consumers. The information explosion. So we're just going to touch on this. We're really experiencing information overload. Do you know that more unique information will be created in the next 2 years than all human history combined? More unique information in the next 2 years than all human history combined. That's incredible. Or here's another way of looking at it. Last year, 5.5 trillion emails. And that doesn't include spam. And that's going to rise by 30% this year. How do we manage? Well, we need new tools. And what is driving this information explosion? It's hard disk capacity. This is the price of 1 gigabyte of hard drive. In 1992, it was about $2,000 per gigabyte. And by 2005, it falls to less than a buck. This is what is driving the incredible information explosion. And here's what's happening to information. If you're on the internet, internet usage has grown almost 2,000% between 96 and 02, whereas television is basically even. And in fact, if you look at certain age groups, young people are watching their PC monitor, they're surfing the net more than they're watching television. And finally, if you're an author like me, book reading is falling 9%. We're reading less. So if you're an author, you'd better not be writing big, fat, thick books. You'd be better writing books that people can get the essence of it really quickly. and you'd better be doing something called repurposing your material. You'd better put it out in audio and video. Creative destruction. So think about in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we had ice companies. And these companies went out to the rivers and streams in the winter, and teams of men would saw out large blocks of ice. And they'd leverage them onto horse-drawn sleighs and pull them to barns, right? And they would insulate them in hay, and in summer they'd chop off blocks of ice and deliver them door to door by horse-drawn carriage. And think of the skill sets or core competencies required to thrive in the ice company. You'd have men who were good with saws, men who were good with horses. First aid might have been useful. You know, the HR department would put on swimming lessons, right? But when refrigeration came along, none of the skill sets here mattered over here. Now you had to work with manufacturing, freon gas, compression motors, wholesale distribution, not direct to consumer. And why is it so hard for organizations to change? Well, because if you were good with horses, you became head horse person. Good with saws, head of the saw department. Good at barn buying, head barn buyer. Woohoo! You know, but now the executive committee is made up of people most vested in the old way of doing business. And that is why it's so hard for organizations to change. The wireless explosion. This shows the number of different devices worldwide. There are about 1 billion mobiles right now, 600 to 700 million PCs, 82 million pagers, and 22 million PDAs, things like the Palm or the iPack or the Visor. Now, I was listening to Jeff Hawkins, who's the CEO of Handspring. He was the founder of Palm Pilot, and it's just been bought this month, reacquired. But he was working with an analyst in New York, a stock market analyst, and she said to him, you know, I can't live without these three devices. My Nokia cell phone, my Research in Motion BlackBerry, and my Handspring Visor. She said, but why do you make me carry all three around? Why can't you give me a single device that would incorporate all three? And all of a sudden, he realized that's what he needed to do, and the Handspring Trio was born. It's a three-in-one device. It's a cell phone. It's a BlackBerry, so you can send and receive all your email on it. You can surf the web on it. And it's a Palm Pilot using the Palm OS. Now, not to be outdone, Research in Motion has brought out their combo product. But let's look at the impact of this. Before, Handspring used to compete in a universe of 22 million. That's your total market. But now that it's a three-in-one device, are they competing in 22 million market, an 82 million market of pagers, or are they also competing in a billion market of mobiles? You see, they have blindsided their competition because they have changed the rules of the game. And if in 10 years' time, or even 5 years' time, we access the web through a Palm Pilot type of multifunctional device rather than our PC, does that not blindside Microsoft? Because Microsoft dominates at the PC level, but if I surf the web now through a little handheld device, does that not blindside Microsoft? And in fact, do you know that more people surf the web in Japan through their mobiles than through PCs? It is already happening. Dohaese's law of learning basically says the only competitive advantage is the ability to learn faster than your competitors. The law of wasted time says that 97% of most organizational processes are waste. Only 3% adds value. This is a fun one. Anybody here ever heard of SETI at home, by show of hands? Okay, a few people. Anybody here see Jodie Foster's movie Contact? Okay, well, this is what it's about. We send out radio signals into space and see what they bounce off, and when they come back to Earth, we analyze them. SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. But the computers to analyze all these radio signals are so vastly expensive that the organization that's doing this can't afford them. So we have 700 million PCs worldwide, most of which are connected to the internet, and most of which are on all the time, but sitting idle. So you download a little screensaver onto your PC, and whenever your PC is idle, it sends a message out to the server, hey, send me some work. And it sends some work to your PC. Do you know they have been able to harness the power thousands of times greater than the most powerful supercomputers on Earth at a thousandth less the price per computational cycle? Boom. Changing the rules of the game. And finally, the environmental imperative. If every organization doesn't orient itself towards preserving our environment, the whole Earth will be blindsided. And so let's ask, are the world's top brands at risk? Well, here's the number one brand worldwide, according to Business Week, Coca-Cola. Anybody here drink Sam's Choice or President's Choice Pop? 38% of all supermarket sales are private label. And there's a little company here in Canada called Cott Beverage. Last year, they sold 2 billion cans of pop through Walmart called Sam's Choice. Boom. Coca-Cola's profit was so hurt here in Canada, they had to move their head office back to Atlanta. Not even the number one brand worldwide is immune to being blindsided. Microsoft, we've already talked about. What happens if I access the web through my handheld in 5 years? And we've already talked about IBM, the maker of the largest mainframes worldwide, being threatened by a little maker of a piece of software that SETI uses. You see, who would think the competitor of a mainframe maker would be the maker of a tiny little piece of software you download onto your PC? In other words, not changing is the greatest risk of all. So let's look at how can we identify some early warning signs to avoid being blindsided. First off, there's a concept called undiscussable. An undiscussable is something that everybody knows about in the organization, but nobody will talk about. It's like there is a large elephant in the family living room that everyone sees, but nobody mentions. Organizations get blindsided because they have these blinders on. We can't talk about something, like there is some orthodoxy, some unspoken law we can't talk about, whatever it is. This is one phenomenon. Anybody here read Kubler-Ross's work on death and dying? Powerful work. Really what it says is if you are diagnosed with a fatal illness, or your spouse is, let's say, God forbid, cancer, you will go through these five emotional stages: denial, anger, depression, bargaining, and finally acceptance. And we go through these five stages with any threat we encounter. Imagine something even as trivial as locking my keys in the car. Honey, before we went into the restaurant, I gave you the keys to the car, didn't I? I can't believe I locked my keys in the car. Loser! God, please leave the hatchback open and I'll be good all week. And then, okay, let's call the Automobile Association. Now, honey, I gave you the cell phone before we went into the restaurant. Now, I'm going to give you some statements, and you tell me which stage they occurred in. These are from industry executives in the recording industry. Napster is not going to make any difference on our business model. Absolutely. That was said, by the way, in February of 2001, while Napster facilitated almost 3 billion file transfers. These kids are pirates. Absolutely. You can download this song, but you can only play it on the device you downloaded it on. That's like saying you can buy a CD, but you can only play it on your car system. You can't play it at home or the cottage or on your Walkman. Absolutely. They really haven't got it. In fact, only Apple really has got it. This is the Chinese character for crisis. In fact, it's two characters. One is danger, and the other is opportunity. whenever you have some radical change in the environment, it is both. And apparently, this looks very similar to mother-in-law. So I want to talk about a concept called Flashpoint. And what is Flashpoint? Anybody here a Shania Twain fan? Woo-hoo! Isn't she great? Well, Shania signed a $3 million contract with Revlon to be their beauty spokeswoman, right? And then a TV crew interviewed her and said, "What is the secret of your beauty success?" And you know what she answered? Bag bomb. Now, anybody a farmer here, you'll know what bag balm is. It is cow ointment. When you milk cows, the teats of the udders get chapped, and they put bag balm on them. It's like chapstick for cow udders. Now, what Shania does, apparently, is scoop this stuff up and put it all over herself, including her hair, and leave this stuff on all day. Now, if you were the maker of bag balm in Canada here, you used to sell 30,000 tins of bag balm a year. Shania goes on television and says the secret of her beauty success is bag balm. You begin selling 30,000 tins a month. Like, these are heady days for the makers of bag balm. And they really don't have their mind around the concept of bag balm as cosmetic yet. You know, because they're used to selling to farmers for $4 a tin, right? They don't get that if they were to sell this to Holt Renfrew, they could sell a tiny little vial of it for $95, right? They're still selling it in $4 tins. Anybody here have any kids who like Avril Lavigne? Avril Lavigne, this is another example of Flashpoint. Avril Lavigne goes on Saturday Night Live and sings Complicated and Skater Boy, and she's wearing a t-shirt that says Napanee Home Hardware. Well, before, you know, she's even finished performing on Saturday Night Live, the phone is ringing off the hook at the Napanee Home Hardware. You know, they come in the next morning and the answering machine has 150 messages on. I gotta have the shirt! So they begin scratching their head. Shirt? What are they talking about? What shirt? Well, apparently Avril was wearing a shirt from when she was 6 years old. That shows you how petite she is. 6 years old when she played on the Napanee soccer team, and Home Hardware sponsored the team, and that's how the shirts were printed. So all of a sudden, Home Hardware begins clamoring around. We got to get some shirts. You know, we got to... Gotta get shirts. And so they talk to the soccer association and they work out a deal. You can sell shirts, but you can only sell them in Napanee, and you can only sell them for $14.95, and all the profit has to go to the soccer association. So they say, fine, okay, you know, we want to help our customers. So first week they sell out 1,000 shirts. Now, how many people in Napanee need a t-shirt? Right? Why are all the people in Napanee buying them? Well, the answer is because they're reselling them on eBay for $35. You see, this shows one of the fundamental principles of blindsided. We live in a global economy, right? Remember that thing about video conferencing with universal real-time translation? You can't have these enforced districts like we used to anymore. So I want to talk about some strategies for prevention. The first off, I want you to imagine you took an antibiotic this morning that had a rather bizarre effect, a 15-second muscular delay. So from the moment your mind says move your hand to when you actually can move your hand, it takes 15 seconds. How effective a driver would you be on the highway? Now, a woman in a presentation a couple weeks ago yelled out, "About average." So, how do most organizations work? You know, you get your financials in most organizations once a quarter. Imagine my body worked the way most organizations do. you know, only gave me biofeedback once a quarter. One of the principles to avoid being blindsided is work in real time. Anybody here know of Zara? Zara is a fashion retailer. There's only one store in the area. It's in Toronto. Zara is the fastest growing retailer in the world. They're the most profitable, and they've made their owner, who is Spanish, the richest man in Spain when they did their IPO on the stock market. And why is Zara doing so well? Because the company treats fashion like fresh fish. Their designers go into the runways of Paris and Milan and they sketch out, or they take their digital camera and take photographs, and those are uploaded to the designers back in the head office in Spain. And within 2 weeks, that clothing is in stores. In fact, they fly their fashion here to Toronto from Spain. They don't do slow boat to China. Now, most retailers, 6 months before the season, have committed to 60% of their inventory. And by the start of the season, have committed to 90% of their inventory, which means in season, they can only have 10% flexibility. But what Zara does is it works in real time. Only 20% ordered pre-season, 50% by the start of the season, which means in season, they have 5 times the flexibility of a normal retailer, which means their sell-offs or discounts are only half of what an average retailer is. The principle is work in real time. Only be selling what the customers want. Second thing is unarticulated needs. I met a mother here in Toronto who had this experience. She was at a four-way intersection, and the van had overshot the intersection, and it wasn't his time to go. So he began backing up. But unbeknownst to him, 3 small children had begun crossing behind the van. And she watched in horror as this guy was backing up. And she thought about honking, but she was terrified she'd frighten the van driver, he'd floor it and kill the kids. So she just had to watch, absolutely powerless. Thankfully, the kids got out of the way. And what she realized is, we need a reverse sonar system on cars, high back cars or vans that tell us when there's something in our blind spot we're about to move into. And so she got in touch with a manufacturer, and they created something called Safe Reverse Sonar. 2 little half-sized ping pong balls are installed on the back of your vehicle, and they warn you when you're backing up, when anything is in your way. And they start beeping faster and faster the closer it gets. So it could be a little dog, it could be a child on a tricycle, it could be anything. It could even be a fire hydrant. It'll prevent you from smashing your car into a fire hydrant. And if you actually look at what Bosch and BMW are installing now, new cars will have 5 systems. 5 different systems. And the last one there is an infrared system. So when you're driving at night and there's a moose on the road 500 yards ahead of you, not even in your high beams yet, a faint image of a moose will come up on your screen and warn you you're about to hit something that you can't even see yet. Fascinating. Fascinating. But how many average consumers will say, what I really want is infrared sonar or infrared systems on my car? The average consumer won't. So if you're a really good researcher, it's up to you to listen to what people's fear and frustrations are and then design positive feature or benefits that will meet those needs. I'd like you to imagine you're VP of marketing and sales for a company that's an industry leader in the fashion industry. And you sell khakis. And every year, you've sold more khakis. I mean, the logical mantra would be more khakis. I mean, you've been promoted, you're VP of marketing and sales because of khaki sales. But this company hired a research firm, and they went out to the core customers. And it wasn't in focus groups, it was with handheld cameras one-on-one in their homes. And they had them open their wardrobe and ask them questions about their clothing. They said, what do you have more of than you've ever had before? And they said, come to think of it, you know, we've got more khakis than ever before. You know, I've got 9 pairs of the things. You know, they don't die. I love them, but they don't die. And then they said, what do you have less of than you've ever had before? And they said, you know, I don't own a single pair of jeans. And you'll notice, 2 years ago, the ad campaigns moved away from khakis and towards denim. Why? Because this research firm advised you need to look at your customer's wardrobe as a receptacle into which you can only push so many pairs of khakis, and they're khakied out. Right? And so this shows us a couple things. It shows us, number one, you have to be willing to embrace contrarian view. You have to get close to your customer, and you have to listen to those unarticulated needs. Reverse mentoring. Who's closest to the future? The 65-year-old CEO who doesn't know how to turn on the computer? Or the 18-year-old who surfs the web every night? Who does all the strategic planning? Who's most disenfranchised from strategic planning? Is it any wonder we only get incremental change? How many recording industry executives do you think go to raves? My point exactly. You know, Jack Welch, top brightest CEO supposedly worldwide, didn't know anything about the internet. And so he got some 20-somethings, some 30-somethings, to come into his office and train him twice a week on the impact of the web on business. This is the first generation where our kids have become our mentors. It's called reverse mentoring. And really, the key is be willing to go into areas you don't know or understand. Be willing to ask for help. Get those 16-year-old kids to show you how to surf the web or how to use the new piece of software. Give you a couple more prevention strategies. It's not good enough to work in real time. The whole organization has to work in real time. Not just the organization, the whole value chain. Think about it this way. If my hand works in real time, but only communicates through my wrist to my arm once every 90 days, is it any good? You see, my organization has to work in real time. My suppliers have to work in real time. Their suppliers have to work in real time. The whole value chain has to work in real time. And so companies like Walmart and Dell are doing that. Change the rules. There's a concept called open source programming, which is where you literally give away the source code to the program. It's like Pepsi publishing the secret recipe to Pepsi and letting everyone in the world, including Coke, look at it. Now, why would you do such a crazy thing? Because everyone in the world is now able to contribute and make the secret recipe better. And so open source companies that make something called Linux are able to have literally hundreds of thousands of software programmers improving the code, whereas at Microsoft there are only 2,500 software engineers who can improve it. Does this mean that open source may blindside Microsoft? Absolutely. Empower your customer. We'll have a look at this. This is what is driving the web adoption. It costs $1.07 to do a transaction face-to-face at a teller at a bank, 52 cents over the phone, 27 cents at an ATM, but only a penny over the web. Now, some people say to me, Jim, the vision you're talking about in the future, there's no valuable human interaction. And I find that an interesting comment, because I never define standing in a bank lineup for a half hour over my lunch hour to be a valuable human interaction. You know, spending time with my friends, that's a valuable interaction. And so we as consumers will automate transactions we never felt add value. FedEx today won't answer 700,000 phone calls. They haven't had to hire 20,000 people as package volumes have grown. And in fact, 2/3 of all customers' queries are answered by customers themselves over the web. And last year, they didn't have to print to pay 2 billion forms, which they would have to courier out and then have their people develop carpal tunnel and pay workers' compensation board claims. And do you know what they've done? They have outsourced all the administration to us as customers, if you think about it. Because we order online, we key in the data of the customer shipments. Here is the advantage cost of being online. At Cisco, 90% of their procurement, their support, and sales are all done online. And Dell, it's well over 70, and sales, they won't publish it now, but my guess is it's over 70 as well. It's definitely over 50. The reason the web is so powerful is if you have a phone call to solve a customer's problem, it costs on average about $33, but over the web, it's a buck if you have a self-serve model. The reason to move more work, administrative work, to the web is this slide right here. So the web isn't just about selling, it's also about reducing our costs. And paradoxically, customers say it increases the value of their service because they have access to their information 24 by 365. I'm going to touch on ROIC. This is called return on invested capital. Think about it this way. When McDonald's first opened, they only served lunches and dinners. When they opened for breakfast, they radically increased their ROIC because they had the same capital, the same buildings and so on, but they now had three meals, not two. When they opened drive-through windows, they radically increased their ROIC. And in fact, do you know that 70% of all McDonald's sales in North America are now drive-through? Which means McDonald's has tripled their revenue with no additional capital investment. Think about it. We're providing the seating in our cars or our homes. We're providing the garbage disposal. We're providing the washroom facilities. And do you know what? They're not charging us any less for our food. Wow. This is what ROIC is all about. Anybody fly Southwest Airlines ever? This is the value of Southwest Airlines compared to its next six largest competitors. So here we have Delta, Northwest, American Airlines, Continental, United, and US Airways. Add them all up, multiply by 3.8, and it's still less than Southwest. Why? Southwest takes only 20 minutes to turn around their planes, meaning from the moment a plane lands, taxis, arrives at the gate, people are disembarked, the plane is groomed or cleaned, new people are loaded on, it pulls back and takes off, is only 20 minutes. Do you know what the industry average is? Well over an hour. If Southwest said that is an acceptable average, they would need 50% more planes to fly the same number of daily flights, which means these are hugely expensive, capital-intensive pieces of equipment. Southwest has the highest ROIC of any airline worldwide. The key is ROIC. It's why it's a profit engine. Here's a fun story. Tim Hortons. I work with YPO, Young Presidents Organization, and I met one of their chaps from PEI. These guys are all under 40 and have $5 million of sales in their company before they're 40. That's the qualification to be a Young Presidents Organization member. And so this YPOer on the island of PEI wanted to open a Tim Hortons in a little town called Montague. But it's too small, only 3,000 people. And Tim Hortons would prefer to have 10 to 12,000 people before they'll let you open a restaurant. But he kept on hassling them. Now, he also owned the franchise for Wendy's for the island of PEI. And so he had an idea. Wendy's wouldn't let him open one either. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a combo restaurant, which is part Wendy's, part Tim's. And Wendy's was in expansion mode, so they said, go ahead. Tim's said no, but he bugged them for 3 years, and finally they said, look, when it fails, it's in PEI. Nobody will know. Ron Joyce, who was the owner at the time, said, "Everything you're doing is wrong. This will fail. I've been in the business so long, I know this will fail. You're breaking every rule of the business. But we'll let you go ahead since nobody knows about it." And so both CEOs flew in, they opened the combo restaurant, and once the combo restaurant was open, staggering synergies appeared. Do you know 65% of Tim's business occurs before 10:30 in the morning? Wendy's doesn't even open till 11. And do you know it's really hard in fast food to give people full-time shifts? But with the combo restaurant, the guy who's the baker becomes the burger flipper at 11 and goes back to baking after. And you know, the lull time for Wendy's is the afternoon and late evening, which is when Tim Hortons is rocking and rolling. And the synergy was so incredible that word began to spread, and others on the east coast of Canada began opening combo restaurants. And they became so successful that word spread to Toronto. And they opened one in Toronto, and then the real synergy appeared. Real estate in Toronto is so expensive that not even McDonald's can afford a prime corner location. But with two restaurants, they could buy it. And they were able to outbid even McDonald's on prime locations. And you know, the synergies became so overwhelming that Wendy's bought Tim Hortons and made the owner the richest franchise owner in Canada. The guy who said it will never work had a guy in PEI to thank. And so the principle here being change the rules of the game.
To finish the presentation, please insert CD number 2. For information on Jim's presentation, visit www.jimharris.com. That's JIMHARRIS.com. We now rejoin Jim giving a live presentation on Blindsided.
Now, I was once in a session with industry executives from Hollywood, and they said, you know, people won't want to watch movies on their computers. And, you know, I thought, well, that's an interesting comment. They said, because, you know, they want the cinematic experience. You know, and if you go and watch Lord of the Rings, you really want that widescreen experience. Or if you watch Bertolucci's The Last Emperor, you want the rich texture of the film. But, you know, if you're watching Dumb and Dumberer 2, you know, you're not going to the movie for the cinematic experience. You know, in fact, my wife won't go with me, right? So that would be something I would watch on my computer, right? So it will change Hollywood. One of the reasons organizations get blindsided is initially they perceive a new technology, a new product, or a new service to be inferior. That is what the Hollywood executives were telling me. The quality is inferior watching a movie that's been downloaded over the internet. Yeah, but for Dumb and Dumber, it's fine. And over time, the quality improves. And so Polaroid was blindsided by digital photography because the industry dismissed digital photography as being a poor quality. There's a fascinating strategy that ants take when they explore for food. If you have an anthill here, the majority of ants, 95%, are efficiently harvesting food from one location. But what the colony does is send other ants to explore a new area, maybe 2 or 3%, and they begin exploring an area, laying down a faint trail to let them know where they've been. And they'll explore this area, and when they find food here, they'll now come back efficiently to the anthill and begin sending more workers along this path. So the principle is, take maybe 1 to 5% of the resources of your organization and explore new technologies, new products, new services. It's not an all or nothing. It's how do we adapt over time? Here really is the essence of the challenge we face today. Microsoft says that every product we make will be obsolete in 3 years' time. It's just a question of whether we'll make it obsolete or our competitors will. This is the environment we're working in. There's a concept called hoteling, and it relates back to what we talked about last night with ROIC, Return on Invested Capital. Consulting firms like Deloitte and Touche or PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, they have these high-priced consultants who have these beautiful offices, very expensive real estate. But if they're actually good consultants, they're never in their office because they're out visiting clients all the time. So what these companies did is they introduced a concept called hoteling. So you don't actually have an office. They give every consultant a really powerful notebook, a cell phone that's connected, and a car allowance or a car, and they say, spend your time with your clients on your client's site, and they reduce their overhead in terms of real estate by 50%. And then if you do want an office, it's like booking a hotel room. You just call in advance and say, I need an office today, and when you arrive at the office, there's an office, and your cell phone is call forwarded to the phone there, and they put the little plaque in the slot, then you have an office. Just the way, whenever you want a hotel room, you book a hotel room, and it's there. And so this concept about let's look at how we are using the capital of our business and use it in a new and more intelligent way. I'm going to give you a couple more blindsided examples. So the first one is, if your brother-in-law is a helicopter pilot who does reporting for traffic in the morning, his job is endangered. Why? Because the new generation of cell phones, called 3G or third generation, will be GPS-enabled, global positioning systems, which means we will be able to tell how fast the traffic is moving on the highways by seeing how fast the cell signals are moving. And you're going to be able to see in fog how fast the cars are moving. And you're going to be able, I predict, in 5 years to have a little application where you'll punch into your cell phone, I'm here in Hamilton and want to go to Pearson International Airport, show me the fastest route. And it will tell you in real time because it will see where all the cell signals are. I once bought a computer printer, an inkjet printer, from a retailer that advertises itself as having low electronic prices. You know the kind. When you go to the checkout, there's a big sign. It says, returns only within 30 days. Must have original receipt. Must have all packaging. Blood sample required, you know. So I'm on the road maybe 100, 150 days a year, and I didn't have the chance to install this printer within the 30-day time frame. I installed it, I hated it, and I wanted to take it back. And I was ready for the fight. You know, I was expecting the clerk to say no, and then I was going to appeal to the manager of the computer section, and then the head of that store, and then the president of the chain, and then go to, you know, the newspaper ombudsman, you know, to campaign for righteousness in retailing. I was ready. Then I got to the front, and the 18-year-old clerk asked me, what's your phone number? I gave her my phone number. She said, Mr. Harris will be happy to take it back. I was actually disappointed. You know, and what was it? Well, she called up my record by keying in my phone number. Our phone numbers are unique. And she saw that I'd bought $7,000 of goods at that store that year, $14,000 at the chain over the last 2 years. And she knew for a $400 printer with $50 of profit, it wasn't worthwhile upsetting me. And so this shows something. It's called making a decision in a moment of truth, a 15-second window when we can either delight or deny the customer what they're asking for. But unless we have real-time information systems that tie all the stores together and give that frontline person real-time information in a moment of truth, you don't know whether this customer is important to you or not. So there's an example of blindsiding. A third example is, I was recently in Quebec City, staying at the Chateau Frontenac, which is a beautiful old hotel right beside the Plains of Abraham. Very historic site. And in the Fairmont Hotel, the moment you pick up the telephone, it costs you $1.61. Make a local call, $1.61. Make a 1-800 call, $1.61. Make a long distance call, it's $1.61, and then they charge you triple the long distance rates, and these are not discounted. So I asked the hotel operator, how much do you think it's going to cost me to call Germany for 10 minutes? Because right now my wife is in Germany doing some work. And they said, oh, we figure it'll be about $100. So what did I do? I took my little notebook here and signed up for the high-speed internet connectivity for $13 for the day. And then I put on the headset that I wear, which has a microphone, plugged it in here, and went to a little application called Net2Phone. And I made a phone call over the internet for 5 cents US a minute. So I talked to my wife for 10 minutes and 3 seconds for 55 cents US, plus the $13 hookup fee. Now, I needed to hook up anyways to the internet to get my emails and surf the web, for instance. But does that mean that all of a sudden hotels may have their revenue blindsided on when they've been expecting to get usurious rates on long distance? Absolutely. Think about the telcos. Do you know that just 10 years ago, telcos made 70% of their revenue from long distance? I already have a little phone card that I can get a cent a minute anywhere in Canada. Fascinating. But what happens when 70% of your revenue used to be in long distance and it's now moving to an almost free commodity? This is the rise in voice over internet protocol. 400 billion minutes will be VoIP by 05. Incredible. Somebody came up to me while I was signing books last night and said, you know, I'm in the nuclear industry, and how could we be blindsided? Well, that's an interesting question. Imagine the government of Ontario launches a program around energy conservation and installs energy-efficient appliances in every home in the province and retrofits people's housing. Would now not energy conservation and insulation be a competitor of electricity generation? Remember from last night, the ice versus the refrigeration. All of a sudden, it could change. And finally, land surveyors. You know, you've seen the land surveyors when they set up those tripods with the measuring tools, and they very accurately measure things and then plot them. Well, they now have outfitted vans with GPS. In other words, the van is always located from satellites, and they put video cameras on the side and the front of the van, and they just drive through the neighborhood. And it correlates all the data in real time with the GPS. And so they're able to plot where are the fire hydrants, where are the houses, etc., because the new GPS systems are accurate within less than a foot. I was wanting to talk about ways that we can avoid being blindsided, and one way is scenario planning. Now, scenario planning comes to us, it's interesting. Anybody see the movie Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers? All right, it's quite the movie. Peter Sellers is one of my favorites. But there was a guy called Herman Kahn who worked for an American firm called the Rand Corporation after the Second World War. And he was studying nuclear war. And he developed scenarios of what could happen. And people found his work so distasteful that one journalist said it was thinking the unthinkable. And Kahn liked that phrase so much, he made it the title of his next book, Thinking the Unthinkable. Now, Kahn didn't like nuclear war, but what he felt was, if you do not study what would actually happen if we had one, you can't prevent it and realize how abhorrent it is and work diligently to make sure it never happens. And in fact, the character in Dr. Strangelove is based on Kahn. In other words, Sellers' character in the movie is based on Kahn. They so vilified him. But that really isn't what he was about. He was about studying these things to say, how can we make sure it never happens? And if we don't understand it, if we blinker ourselves, if we're in denial, then it enables it actually to occur. And so if this is the recording industry, back to the slide, we could develop three scenarios. Notice the black bars in all three. These are trends that we all feel are going to happen in the future, so they should be involved in every scenario. Like, our computer is going to be more powerful next year. Is bandwidth going to be increasing? So we need those in all of them. And then these other colors are ones we're not sure about whether they're going to occur. And we mix and match these to develop three scenarios. The red scenario at the bottom there could, for instance, be a digital music future. Now, if you were in the music industry in the early 90s, it was impossible to share a file across the internet. Why? Well, it wasn't impossible, but it was near impossible. To share a 4-minute song between two people on the internet would have taken 40 hours. 40 hours. Why? Because there was no compression technology, and we had very thin bandwidth. So if you were doing scenario planning as an executive, you would have said that this red scenario is impossible because it takes 40 hours to share a 4-minute song. Well, when you're doing scenario planning, you suspend disbelief. You say, let's really imagine this was possible, and what would it take to make it happen? Let's look where we are and look back and say, what were the triggers that would enable a digital music future? And you'd say, well, you'd need 100-fold increase in bandwidth, or you'd need 100-fold improvement in compression technology, or you'd need a 10-fold improvement in both multiplied by each other. And therefore, if we ever see these conditions occurring in the marketplace, a digital music future becomes more likely. It doesn't guarantee it will occur. It's just like saying we're going to take oxygen, a spark, and a combustible and put them all together. It doesn't guarantee you're going to have a fire, but a fire certainly becomes more probable when those three conditions are present. And so scenario planning is all about backcasting to your triggers and saying, if we do see these things occur, how would we behave? And an executive team that has done this has already gone through those 5 stages of death and dying. And when they see them, they can immediately begin to respond where all their competitors are caught in denial, still saying, Napster won't make any difference to our industry. We're going to have a fun little exercise. If you were to go to people on the street and say, what are the benefits of being a leader? What do you think people would say? What are the benefits of being a leader? You get success. You get power. Great. What else? You get control. Great. What else? You get influence. And I heard somebody else say possibility. Great. What else? You get respect. Oh, you get independence, discernment, meaning you get to figure out where we're going. Okay, responsibility. You get money. You get recognition. Larry Wilson boiled all these things down to just 3 things. He said, typically the answers fall into one of these 3 categories: power, control, and being served. That's like ego needs, perks, and pay. What I'd like you to do is to partner up with the person next to you, and you're going to be talking about an incident that you had with a leader that was transformational or magical. Think about some interaction in your life that you've had with a leader that for you was transformational or magical. It could be a leader in your community, it could be in business, it could be in your family, it could be in a church or a religious organization. It really doesn't matter what the context was. But think of some interaction you had with a leader that was literally magical or transformational for you. And I want you to talk with your partner a little about that experience, and I want you to figure out what were the characteristics the leader exhibited that made that interaction so magical. We're just going to take 2 or 3 minutes on this, and then we'll come back together as a large group. So, partner up and share about that magical experience and what were the characteristics that made it so magical. okay, we're going to come back together as a large group, and I want to see what insights you had into what made that experience so magical or transformational. So you can just yell out, what was it? What was it the leader exhibited, or what made it such a memorable event for you? Accepted. We felt accepted. Great. They were interested in our needs. They were visionary and inspiring. They empowered me. They were self-assuring. They were disciplined. Okay, that's great. They were the servant. Wow. They were humble. They were patient. They had a strong belief. They were generous. They had integrity. They showed me that they cared. They were available. Always positive. They were fearless. There was really a heartfelt connection. They were tolerant. They were passionate. Hands-on. What about credit? They were committed. People will often say they gave me credit, or they were interested in what I had to say, or they were interested in my vision. Now, if we actually look at these words and what the average people in society say, rather than the leader is the one who gets all the attention, the respect, they're the successful one, they have the power, they have the control, they get the respect, they set the direction. Here, it's exactly the opposite. They accepted us rather than demanding the respect or the attention. They were interested in us and our opinion and our needs, not giving us always just theirs. They empowered us. They were passionate. They were self-assured, and they helped us develop our own sense of self-assuredness. Disciplined. This is a powerful one. Do you know Albert Schweitzer said, in influencing others, example is not the best way, it is the only way. Really, people pay attention to what we do, not to what we say. They were the servant. In fact, this is the lesson out of this. We get a notion of servant leadership. The role of the leader is to serve the individuals in the organization. I think about leadership like gardening. What does the gardener do? If there is no gardener, there is no garden. If there is no gardener, which grows faster, the weeds or the plants? Absolutely. But what does the gardener do? The gardener works on the context. The gardener weeds and waters and churns the soil, but the plants grow themselves. You see, individuals in our organization have to grow themselves. Leadership is about providing the context for them to grow in, but they have to grow themselves. You know, it's like a coach for a track team. A coach can tell you why it's important to exercise and work out to be prepared for the track meet. A coach can show you how to work out. A coach can actually work out with you, but a coach can't work out on your behalf. If my coach goes running and I don't, I get no benefit from it. You see, the leader works on the context. Now, it's not just good enough to remove bad habits. I had a friend who went away to London, England for 6 weeks, and before she went away, she weeded her entire garden. But she only had time to plant new plants in half of the garden. When she came back from England, the side that she hadn't had time to plant plants on was once again overrun with weeds. But the side where she had planted plants, there were some weeds, but they were very small. Why? Because the flowers that she had planted were competing for the air, the water, the resources. So it's not just good enough in leadership to work to help people remove bad habits. We have to encourage positive new habits. Ken Blanchard has a new book. I've forgotten the title, but it looks at the study of training whales. I don't know if you've been to SeaWorld or something like that, but they have those killer whales like Shamu, the orcas, and they get these whales to jump 30 feet above the water. It's just absolutely incredible. Now, if you're a whale trainer, how do you train, you know, a 3-ton whale? Because you actually, as the trainer, get in the pool with the whale. So you don't want to be punishing the whale to train them. That would be very bad. How do they actually train a whale to jump 30 feet out of the water? Well, they start with a rope, and they get the whale to go over the rope. And whenever it goes over the rope, they reward it. Where did they begin with the rope? Underwater. So whenever Shamu swims over, he gets fish. Swim under, they just ignore him. Because you don't want to punish a 3,000-pound killer whale. Because he could crush you with his teeth in a single bite. Every time Shamu goes over, it gets fish. Shamu's a bright guy. And what you do? You gradually raise the rope until eventually it's out of the water. But you want to give people a challenge that's always within their capacity. There's a chap who's written a book called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. The real job of leadership is to match individual skills with the challenge. So give me a challenge that's 10 or 20% greater than my current capacity. That is exciting. Because I know I can get there, and I might stumble along the way. But the key is encouraging people. So really, when we look at these two sets of words, what people on the streets say are the benefits of leadership are exactly the opposite of the characteristics of what we would say make magical leaders. I find this a very powerful exercise. So how can you blindside the competition? Imagine I was working once with a group of electricians. These are certified electricians. And they were really upset. There have been such a boom in housing that people are getting non-certified electricians to wire their homes. And the electricians are really worried because they're losing jobs to people who undercut them because they're bidding ridiculously low prices. How could you avoid that from happening? Well, I suggested get together as a lobby group and lobby insurance companies to say, we will not pay claims on fires that occurred in homes that were not wired by certified electricians. Might that change the rules of the game? Might that help certified electricians blindside their non-certified competition? Or, we talked last night about open source. That's like Pepsi publishing its secret recipe for Coke to see it. And a CEO of a mining company went down to MIT for an executive development session and heard about this concept of open source. And so he decided to apply it to his industry. Now, you'd think mining, that's very old economy, as opposed to new economy being software and intellectual development. How could you apply open source to mining? Well, all the geologists and seismic engineers are very secretive with their data. And what this particular company did, it's called Goldcore, is they published all their seismic and geographic data on the internet for every geologist in the world to see and comment on. And they created a competition with $250,000 of prize money for the number one entrant or the number one winner and said, tell us where we should mine. And now all of a sudden they had geologists from Russia and Australia all around the world working to tell them what they should do with their mine. And you know, they developed new insights that they never had before. The other thing that was very powerful is they put out a piece of software on the web that allowed every geologist worldwide to do analysis in 3D. So it's 3D modeling software for your computer. And you know, their own engineers didn't know how to use it because it's this learning curve. You know, fear of this being duck out of water. It's the learning paradox, not being comfortable with the new technology. Well, you know, when the executives start getting excited about the Australian entry because of the modeling, do you think the engineers here begin to learn it? Like, geez, everyone around the world is doing this. We're not. Their pride forced them to get competitive with the new technology. And as a result of this competition, they more than doubled their proven reserves because of the input of analysis from around the world. And in fact, while the competition cost them less than $1 million to run, they figured they got $10 million worth of consulting services globally. Is this not changing the rules of an old economy organization? And finally, obsolete your core product. I'm going to talk about something called the value vortex. And this basically states that whenever we have a product or service, over time, what is value changes. So, for instance, think about the ATMs. You know, when banks introduced ATMs 20 years ago, that was unique. What was the nature of what you could charge if you were the only bank in the area that had an ATM? What was the nature of competition? But once others began putting in ATMs, they became just a value add. It's still pretty cool, but others have it. And then today, would you deal with any financial institution that didn't have ATMs? You see, now it's become a core insistence. And as you move down the value vortex, competition increases and margin compresses. So organizations therefore have to move up and create new products or new services. That's what we talked about last night with the unarticulated needs. You see, these set of dots are just potential value out there. And so as an organization, we have to always be questioning, how do we add yet more value? How do we determine what is of value? And I'll give you a real life story. I was once staying at a 5-star resort. You know, you can tell it's a 5-star resort because the moment you walk into the lobby, there are fresh cut flowers. I mean, birds of paradise. They're exquisite. They must be spending tens of thousands of dollars on flowers every month. And the decor, incredible. You know, these events always start very early in the morning, often after what has been a very good night the night before, if you know what I mean. And so I looked to the clock radio, but there was no clock radio, you know, the little kind of plastic clock radio. I guess the hotel felt we're a 5-star establishment, clock radios are below us. So I called the front desk and asked for a wake-up call for 6 a.m. And the next morning, I woke up before the wake-up call. I can sometimes do that. It's uncanny. And I went over to the windows, you know, that have those big, heavy, thick drapes, and I threw them back, and it was very bright out. This was my first bad sign of the day. And I looked over to see what time it was, but there was no clock radio. So I called the front desk. It was 8:05. I am naked in my room, supposedly presenting 5 minutes ago. Now, it's a bad visual, so don't go there. But what did the fresh-cut flowers have to do with my customer satisfaction? Or what did the decor or the setting have to do with it? And we can really take a graph and plot how well are we doing something at the bottom, and on the vertical axis, how important is it? And we can plot two things. The flowers, the organization is doing an excellent job. But you know, as long as they had fresh cut in the lobby, I don't need fresh cut throughout the whole property. You could put silk flowers. But the wake-up call was very important to me, and the organization was doing a very poor job. And we can now plot maybe 40 or 50 points of customer service all over this map and divide it into 4 quadrants. And the bottom right quadrant is things we're doing an exceptional job at, but the customer really doesn't care about. And the bottom left quadrant is things we're doing a terrible job at, and thankfully, the customer doesn't care about. And what we really need to do is stop investing time, energy, and effort in these activities and invest the time and energy and resources into the activities of things that are very important to customers that we're doing a terrible job at. Now, do you know what it turned out to be in my hotel room? The person in the room before me had turned the ringers off the phones. So, in fact, they had had a wake-up call, I guess, but it had been an automated call, and when I didn't answer, they didn't send a human being to knock on my door and wake me up. What we really need to do is we need to be exceptional at the things the customer most values. And we need to do something called forced ranking. I remember a company that made executive jets went to executives and they said, do you want faster planes? Yes. Do you want mahogany paneling? Oh, that sounds nice. Would you like a coffee maker in the galley? Yeah. And would you like chairs that fold down into comfy beds? That sounds lovely. They kept on going. They'll say yes to absolutely everything. And then at the end you say, well, are you willing to pay another $250,000? Absolutely not. So what you need to do is force rank things. If you have to choose between a faster plane and a coffee maker, which is it? And you go through and pair these all off until you finally find out all they really cared about was faster plane, longer range. Everything else can be an option. So in other words, we have to be the absolute best on the things that matter most to our customer. Now we can add some dimensions to this analysis. Well, let me just ask here. Many people think that it's price that matters. Sir, I hate to break this news to you here at summer conference like this, but you're going to have a heart attack in 3 weeks unless you have a triple bypass. What's your name?
Terry.
Now, Terry can find only two surgeons in the marketplace who can do this work. One, years of experience, incredible track record, 10 grand. The other, just out of school, desperate for the experience, willing to do it for 50 bucks. Which one are you going to go for, Terry? 10,000. Which one's your spouse going to go for?
10,000.
How price sensitive is Terry? Is that a 5 or 10% price difference? It's 20,000% difference in price. Here is the simple principle. Find the customer's deep pain and they cease to be price sensitive. Find the customer's deep pain and they cease to be price sensitive. Or similarly, price does not equal value. Price does not equal value. In fact, in Terry's situation, he will probably work to find the most expensive surgeon that he can find as a sign of somebody who's in high demand and exceptionally competent. Now imagine after some more research, Terry finds a third surgeon. So you have the 10 grand surgeon who can do it this week, the equally competent surgeon, and she can do it in 4 months' time. She's only going to charge you 2 grand. And by the way, the kid is now willing to pay you 50 bucks. And remember, you're going to have your heart attack in 3 weeks. Which are you going to go for? 10 grand. The competence being equal, now it's how quickly can you deliver? Being able to serve clients rapidly may be a key differentiator in this blindsiding environment that we're operating in. Here's a fun thing. Anybody here eat President's Choice decadent chocolate chip cookies? Anybody a fan? Okay. Well, Dave Nickel, when he worked for Loblaws, went to the baker that they used to bake their cookies with and said, look, we've just done some survey work with these really bright MBAs, you know, just out of Harvard Business School, guys and girls, super bright. They studied the cookie market. And they did extensive studies, statistically valid studies, and they came up with some absolutely staggering results. Apparently, people who like chocolate chip cookies like chocolate chips. I know, I was staggered by the research myself. You know, but that's why you pay the consultants the big bucks. So, Nickel went to the baker and they said, based on this research, we want to double, triple, quadruple the number of chocolate chips in our chocolate chip cookies. We want to rebrand them. And the baker said, look, Dave, we love you, but you don't understand. If we put that many chocolate chips in the cookie, they go through these conveyor belts and they actually melt the chocolate while they're baking the cookie. And with that many chocolate chips in the cookie, we'll just have piles of melted chocolate with cooked batter goo between them. The cookie can't hold together at the heat we bake it at. And Dave said, well, it's been great dealing with you all these years. Thanks. We're taking our business elsewhere. And five bakers later, he found a baker who was too stupid to know that this was impossible. And they redesigned the way they bake cookies. And they ended up with a cookie that has more chocolate by weight than any other cookie in Canada. And you know, it's the number one selling cookie, but it's only available at 20% of the retail outlets. How do you absolutely dominate a market with only 20% distribution? You have to give the customers something that they absolutely love. Find out what the customer's deep delight is, and they cease to be price sensitive. Here's another principle. Value is that which the customer will pay for. If customers won't pay for something, they're really saying they don't value it. Why bother including it? Unless it's a core insistence like ATMs. And here's a great quote by Nickel. Loyalty is the absence of a better value alternative. Loyalty is the absence of a better value alternative. If I want people to be loyal, how do I always add more value for them? This is the concept of servant leadership we talked about earlier. I'm going to talk about customer relationship management, CRM. This is a really hot topic. Why? Because Lexus represents only 2% of Toyota's sales, but 33% of their profit. Or in the UK, 6% of cola drinkers drink 60% of all cola. Wouldn't it be important to know who those people were? Or in banking, 27% of customers on average generate over 100% of the bank's profit. In other words, not all customers are created equal. And if you treat all customers the same, you will treat your best customers like your worst, and you will treat your worst customers like your best, which means that you will be most at risk of losing your best customers, and you'll be guaranteed to keep your unprofitable ones. Now, if that isn't a recipe for disaster, I don't know what is. If you're an average car rental company and you wanted to thank your customers, how would you do it? Well, they might invite everyone to a baseball game. And in the baseball stadium, the way you'd thank your customers would be on the Jumbotron, because you treat them all the same way. Many retailers, for instance, don't even know the names of their customers, let alone how they represent different value to the organization. So an average car rental company would advertise on the Jumbotron or make announcements over the PA. The best customers of an average car rental company, customers that make 25% of their profit, would be just 80 people. 80 people out of this crowd of 40,000 represent 25% of the profitability of an average car rental company. Wouldn't it be important to know who those 80 people are? Wouldn't it be important that you lock them in to your product or service such that they will never leave? Now, most organizations, because they don't treat customers differentially, are at risk of losing those 80 most important customers. Imagine a competitor of this organization could identify who those people potentially were, send 80 sales reps into their competitor's appreciation event, have them sit down beside them during the game, buy them a hot dog and a beer, and say, what would it take to win your business? Theoretically, they could walk out of that event with 25% of the organization's profitability, and the other organization would be left serving 39,920 customers with 25% less profit. If that isn't a recipe for disaster, I don't know what is. Really, it's Pareto's law, the 80-20 rule. 20% of your customers will yield 80% of your profit. But do we know who those are, and do we treat them differentially? If 20% of your customers generate 80% of your profit, are you spending 80% of your time with them? Likely not. I haven't met very many organizations that do. I've taken the 80-20 rule and broken it down into the 20-60-20 rule. 20% of our customers yield 80% of our profit, 60% of our customers yield 40% of our profit, and the bottom 20% drag our profitability. So we developed three strategies for these three different groups. For the first group, it's customer intimacy and creating barriers to exit. That's why airlines require frequent flyer requalification. You need to requalify every year in order to get the perks. So you can't fly with a competitive airline because you risk losing your frequent flyer status. That's a barrier to exit. Or customer intimacy, really deeply understanding your customer. Imagine I forget my mother-in-law's birthday until the day of. And in a panic, I call a florist and say, please courier her over some flowers. The next year, 3 weeks in advance of my mother-in-law's birthday, I get an email from that florist reminding me of her birthday and saying, we posed as a survey firm polling Canadians on their favorite flowers, and we found from your mother-in-law her top three favorite arrangements. Here they are with the prices. Who are you going to deal with? Imagine they take it one step further, and with my permission, they find out key partners of mine what their wedding anniversaries are, what their spouses' birthdays are, and they find out their favorite things, and warn me 3 weeks in advance and every time, who am I going to deal with? Now, here's how it applies to blindsided. The majority of flowers, cut flowers in Canada, are imported from Latin America. Imagine there is a blight or a disease, and the federal government bans the import of all flowers. Every florist goes bankrupt. But our florist, because they have the relationship with the customer, the day after begins selling chocolates and champagne. Because, you see, it's the relationship with the customer, not the product, that's important. Is something called the Harvey McKay 66. 66 questions about your customer to get to know them really intimately. And I was listening to Harvey at a conference in 95 speak about it. And he was talking about a guy called Ken Medima, who's a blind pianist. And he began rattling off the answers to the Harvey McKay 66. And I listened. And on. And on it went. What college and university Ken went to, how he'd originally become blind, what his wife's favorite flowers were, where he went to school, where he went to high school, on and on. And I became more and more embarrassed because Harvey McKay knew more about Ken Medima than I knew about my own father. The Harvey McKay 66. Get to know your most important customers really deeply. What is important to them? What are their most favored charities? Finally, cross-sell. Here's why cross-selling is so important. This is how much churn exists in the first year. So for new customers for a bank, 50% of customers who sign up just for a checking account will leave the bank in the first year. For a savings account, it's only 33%. But add those two together, look, it drops to just 10%. Add in a third product, like a mortgage, it drops to 2%. Add in a fourth product, like a retirement savings, it's less than 1%. Here is the principle. We need to cross-sell as many products and services to our most important customers as possible because it creates a barrier to exit. Would you agree here that if you were purchasing a big ticket item, a $10,000 difference in price would be a significant amount? Would you agree 10 grand is a lot? Okay, imagine that you can find a house down your street, three blocks, that's exactly like your house, and it's 10 grand cheaper. Are you going to move? No? Why not? Too much trouble. You know, the cost of the move, the hassle about the movers breaking your family heirlooms, the scratches on the furniture, living out of boxes for the next 4 years because we still haven't unpacked the boxes from the last move. the fact that you're not going to have your telephone or cable service for 3 weeks, the fact that your phone is not connected properly or doesn't work, the hassle isn't just worth it. This is a barrier to exit. The more products and services we cross-sell our clients, the more loyal they are to us. With our unprofitable customers, we should, one, automate transactions. That's why it's so important that you do everything over the web. The cost of transactions are so much lower. Secondly, profile lifetime value. If there's somebody who has a high potential, you want to carry them even while they're unprofitable, like a student who's going to be a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer. Even though they're unprofitable for a bank right now, the lifetime value, they will be. But if after all that they don't have a lifetime profit, get the business card of your most ferocious competitor and refer that individual to them. If we can get a couple microphones out here so that we can do some questions or comments.
Yes, Mr. Harris, I get very excited reading your work. I read Learning Paradox, I've read Blindsided. I get very excited about your insights and ideas. And what I'm wondering is could you just give us a few thoughts or insights right now about why we should be excited about our industry and where we're going in the future?
Absolutely. Education over the internet is going to be so big, it's going to make email usage look like a rounding error. Remember that little video screen next to the woman's eye last night? Imagine that I can get access to any amount of training on any subject, anywhere, at any time. Do you know that in education, there is a principle that if you don't use something within 48 hours, you will lose it? So if you don't apply what we've been talking about over the last 2 days, in the next 2 days, you will lose the majority of it. So that's why taking notes is so important. But the most important thing is actually putting it into practice. You know, I think that knowledge is what's really important. You know, I read a book a week. I just consume stuff. You know, I'm looking for the secret, the answer, the 7 steps, you know, the 4 keys, the 19 fatal flaws. You know, I'm looking for the secret to success, to happiness, to fulfillment. Boom, I want it, you know? But I have never been able to read my way into physical fitness. Now, I've tried a few times. But you see, it's not the head knowledge that's important. It's the application. And so we really need to work on application. You have all these incredible tools. So this greatly enriches our lives. I was talking to somebody last night, and he said, you know, from last summer conference, you told us about Dragon Naturally Speaking, which is a little headset I wear, and this computer runs this piece of software, and it takes dictation at 160 words a minute with 99% accuracy. He said, I was so excited about what you talked about, I went out and got Dragon Naturally Speaking. And I now estimate it saves me 7 hours a week in typing. I can't tell you, that made my whole day yesterday. The application of knowledge is what's important. And the incredible benefit I see here at InterBiz, most people in society are not in a system that continually encourages them to learn and grow and develop. We'll take another question.
And that one thing that you did mention about getting as much information from your customers and 66 different things. How can you do that so that people won't think it's an invasion of their privacy?
Yeah, you can't do it. Okay, customer, question number one. You do it just informally in interacting with people. You know, when somebody says, you know, yellow roses are my favorite roses, I make a note of it. And next time I'm going to send them roses, what color roses do I send them? It's not a technique like an interview technique. It's just a sensitivity to understand what's important. I just found out somebody who's very important to me in my life, one of my key partners, his son just had a bone marrow transplant. That would be a charity perhaps I would donate to this year and send him a note about it. So how do I add value? for my customers from their perspective, what's important to them, not what's important to me. Great. Another next question.
How far behind are the Waltons of Walmart on getting online?
Okay. I believe they were late out of the gate, but where they are very good is being the largest retailer in the world. They have incredible purchasing power. And they are continually working to lower the cost of their business, always to be a low-cost producer. So one of the keys to avoid being blindsided is always be willing to question orthodoxy. Always be willing, in other words, there are no sacred cows. We're willing to question everything. We'll take another question.
I know in the U.S. we see a lot of news reports about the security of the internet, and I run into it a lot about people not wanting to use the credit cards and things on it. How's the best way to approach that?
Some people don't want to use their credit cards. Well, that is a fear that they have personally that holds them back. Do you know when you give your credit card to a waiter or waitress at a restaurant, that is far more insecure than using it over the web? Because there are these little things they can wear on their hips that they swipe their card on their hip and it captures all the data from your card. And then it's emailed over to Hong Kong and a card is produced and away they go. Boom. So in fact, it's a demographic thing. If you looked, my grandmother, while she was alive, never used an ATM. Why? Because one, she feared it would steal money for her account. And secondly, she was worried about pushing a wrong button and blowing up the banking system. So how do you overcome fear? You actually have to walk the person through it. So what banks had to do is have staff out by the ATM actually walking customers through how to do it. You have to help them through that fear barrier. And once you've tried it, do you know, I book a ton of airline tickets online because it's the middle of the night. You know, I want to book a ticket and there's no travel agent open. So I just go on the web. It's 2 a.m. I pick the flight. I put in my number, click, away it goes. I get the ticket emailed to me. It's very convenient for me. And by the way, it lowers the cost of transaction for the airline. But once you've done it once and had a good experience, it's great. So here's another principle. You'd better make sure their first experience is positive. If you're going to walk the customer through, make sure it works right the first time, because you'll only add to their fear if it doesn't. Test your demo before you do it. It's been such a pleasure to be here with you.
You have been listening to Jim Harris speaking on Blindsided. If you would like to comment on materials you've just heard, you can email Jim directly at jimh@jimharris.com. That's jimh@jimharris.com. That's jimh@jimharris.com. If you would like more information about Jim's presentations, visit www.jimharris.com. Other best-selling books by Jim Harris include The Learning Paradox and Emotional Learning, and are both available on audio CD. Training videos for use within your organization are also available. The Learning Paradox was nominated for the National Business Book Award and is published in 80 countries worldwide by John Wiley & Sons of New York. There are over 40,000 copies in print. The Learning Paradox argues that 80% of the technology we use in our daily lives in just 10 years hasn't been even invented yet. So, job security for individuals and market share security for organizations is now based on learning, changing, and coping with uncertainty. Paradoxically, these are what we as adults fear most. The Learning Paradox has helped thousands of executives deal with the challenges of change and align their organizational systems and structures to remain industry leaders. If you have enjoyed Blindsided, then The Learning Paradox is an excellent follow-on book. Order today from www.jimharris.com.